Well, good morning. It has become painfully obvious, was probably before the week began, that we're not going to get through the book of Hosea. I had put in the description of the class that we were going to read all 14 chapters and comment on them as time permits. I'm not going to be able to do that, at least do it well. So here's my plan. What I hope to do is take us through the rest of the fourth chapter and maybe through the first 9 to 12 verses of the fifth chapter between today and tomorrow. And then on Friday, we're going to jump to chapter 11. That's a part of the book we don't want to miss. It's been said that John is the apostle of love in the New Testament, and Hosea is the prophet of love in the Old. And I don't know of any place in the whole Bible where, the whole Old Testament anyway, where God expresses his love in such strong tones as he does in Hosea 11. So, Lord willing, that'll be our text for Friday. Yesterday, we went through just a few verses. We had what I hope was some profitable discussion, but we didn't cover a lot of ground in the chapter. In verse 3, God says, in light of the sins enumerated in verses 1 and 2, that the land is now going to mourn. And what did we note that was a reference to? Yeah, to drought. There were three different passages I cited, and I thought afterwards, remember back in chapter 2, in verses 21 and 22, where God is giving us that progression of one group asks for something and the next group answers. God answers the heavens, and the heavens answer the earth. And what is it that the earth is asking for? Well, the earth calls out to the heavens for rain. Now, of course, if the heavens answer no, this causes the land to mourn. And that's the idea being drawn on here in verse 3. And of course, everyone's going to waste away as a result of it. No rain, no food, not for anybody. Let no man contend, he says in verse 4. Let no man contend or rebuke another. In light of what's coming, this is what the righteous will want to do. The righteous will want to go to his fellow Jew and say, have you heard what's coming? Are you paying attention? You need to change your ways, but God says don't. And why? Why not contend or rebuke anymore? Because of the kind of people you're dealing with. Do not cast your pearl before swine. You're dealing with people who reject what the priest says. When they can't get something answered locally, oh yeah, they might go through the motions. They might go to the priest. But then when the priest, who's the God's supreme court in this matter, offers his decree and you're supposed to follow it, eh. They openly reject it. And God says such a person's worthy to die. So don't contend with them. They're going to get what's coming to them. Verse 5, you shall stumble in the day. The fall related to the coming distress and destruction, it's coming. In the day when you would think you're sure-footed and can avoid stumbles, you're going to stumble. It's unavoidable. Not just you, but the priests. These false priests who are proclaiming all this peace and safety when there really isn't any, they're going to fall too in the night. The light of day will not help you. The darkness will not hide you. I'm going to destroy your mother. The nation as a whole, again, is going to be destroyed. Let me offer a few comments on this for just a moment. We discussed yesterday how to account for Anna, who's from the tribe of Asher and mentioned in Luke 2, in light of the fact that we don't have any of the 10 tribes mentioned in the return in Ezra and Nehemiah. One of the passages we cited was 2 Chronicles 30, where Hezekiah had sent to the north, inviting them to come down to worship, and we'd seen people from Asher, Manasseh, and Zebulun come down. In 2 Chronicles 11, and I don't remember which one of you it was who pointed this out to me, but there's something that was staring me right in the face and I had missed it. 2 Chronicles 11, after we're told that the priests left Israel, the Levites left Israel to go to Judah in the days of Jeroboam, notice what else it says in verses 16 and 17. And, this is in the days of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and after the Levites left, those from all the tribes of Israel, such as set their heart to seek the Lord God of Israel, came to Jerusalem to sacrifice to the Lord God of their fathers. So they strengthened the kingdom of Judah and made Rehoboam the son of Solomon strong for 3 years. So all the way to the beginning, there had been people from the other tribes coming down. And they may have stayed there once they got down there. There was also some of that in the days of Asa, 2 Chronicles chapter 15, verse 9. Folks from Ephraim, Manasseh, and Simeon came down during the reforms of Asa. So if these are folks who are coming down and staying all along, there had been people coming down where because they saw that Judah was more faithful than Israel. And also, it was obvious, but no nation is an island. I mean, even our own nation, we've got people from all over the world in it. And that certainly would have been true of Judah. So it's really not hard to account for the presence of those other tribes in the promised land after the captivities. Verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. We had quite a conversation about that. The priest had rejected knowledge, and God was going to reject them. They should have been leaders leading the people in righteousness, but they had just become the blind leading the blind, and both were going to fall into the ditch. Whoever these priests are, God was going to reject them and their children as well. They would no longer fill that role. And if these are Jeroboam's priests, certainly the message is, what Jeroboam started, I, God, am stopping. I'm through putting up with it. It's not going to exist anymore. We're ready now for verse 7. Let's read verses 7 through 10. The more they increased, the priests, the more they sinned against me. I will change their glory into shame. They eat up the sin of my people. They set their heart on their iniquity. And it shall be like people, like priest. So I will punish them for their ways and reward them for their deeds. For they shall eat, but not have enough. They shall commit harlotry, but not increase, because they have ceased obeying the Lord. The more they increased. He was talking about the prophets before, the priests before. He talks about them afterwards. So we're talking about the priests. The more they increased, the more they sinned. You know, ideally, it's good if you have more priests. The more priests you have, the more there are to teach God's law, the more people there are to handle the Lord's work. But these, of course, were not the kind of priests you wanted. And so the more of them there were, the more problem you had in the nation. Increase may refer to more than just increase in population here, though. The word is very generic. It can refer to an increase in many things, not only in number, but in honor, in glory, in abundance, in riches. If you notice in Amos chapter 7, verse 13, Bethel, which was one of the seats of idolatry in Israel, Amos chapter 7, verse 13, Amaziah, priest of Bethel, one of these priests of Jeroboam's, he says to Amos, Amos 7:13, never again prophesy at Bethel, for it is the king's sanctuary, and it is the royal residence. Now, who had first set up the calf in Bethel? Jeroboam the king. So from the very beginning, it had a connection to the court. But if you have a holy place, a man-made religion made by the king, and that holy place has retained a connection to the king's court, and you're a priest there, where's that put you in the kingdom? Pretty high. And as time had progressed, perhaps that place had grown higher. We know that in Egypt, the priests held a very high place, at least at a certain time in that nation's history. As you increased in power and prestige and wealth and in station, your sin increased as well. God says, I'm going to turn their glory into shame. All these things that they take pleasure in, maybe even the idol worship itself, I'm going to turn into shame. You're going to lose it all. Heads that had been held high are going to be hanging. It makes me think of Haman. Remember Esther? Haman, he's being raised to this high place in the kingdom. One day Esther just invites him and Ahasuerus to the feast. Esther 5, he's on cloud 9. Verse 10 and 11, he even invites his family. He gets home from that feast, invites his family. And it says in verse 11 of Esther 5, Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Everything's going great. I've got money, I've got children, I've got power. Rejoice with me, family. Next morning, he goes to Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus says, what shall be done for the man in whom the king delights to honor? And what does Haman think to himself? It would be, we are laughing. I mean, it's just incredibly funny, and yet it's painful. Well, it must be me. So he gets this big explanation, go do that for Mordecai. So he does it. And in Esther 6:12, after he parades Mordecai around, doing all those things he'd hoped for himself, it says, Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. He was ashamed. A man who just 12, 15 hours ago had been at his height of power and self-confidence, now is covering his head, hoping not to be seen. And then, before the day's out, what's happened? He's hanging on the gallows. The king finds out what he's guilty of. The king goes out to walk around, and Haman's pleading with Esther, and apparently the king comes in and thinks maybe he's assaulting Esther, And it says in Esther 7, verses 8 and 10, they cover Haman's face. That's what the Persians would do before they went to execute him. They cover his face and they carry him off. From glory to shame in a moment. And these priests may have been in process of experiencing the very same thing. God said in verse 8, they eat up the sin of my people. I think there's a play on words here, or there may well be anyway. The word sin means just what we would expect it to, an offense towards God, but it also means something else sometimes. 50 plus times in the book of Leviticus, this word is translated sin offering. They eat up the sin offering of my people. Leviticus 6, verse 26, the priest who offers the sin offering for sin shall eat it. In a holy place it shall be eaten, in the court of the tabernacle of meeting. So not only are they enjoying the sins of the people, but they're enjoying the sins of the people because when the people sin, the people bring these sin offerings and the priests get to benefit from it. They get to eat it up. And there may have been gluttony at work here. And of course, you can bring in more. You can sell it possibly and make some more money. But that's what's driving these men. What did Paul say in Philippians 3, about enemies of the cross of Christ? Do you remember? Yes. Philippians 3, 18 and 19, Paul talked about enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, whose glory is their shame. Notice the parallels. Who set their mind on earthly things. That's the kind of men you have here. These are enemies of true worship. Oh, they're righteous, they're holy, they look like God's priests, or they look like the men we ought to be looking up to, but just like the Pharisees, inside they're full of dead men's bones, and they're leading people astray and polluting them, and the people don't even know it. And they're glad. Keep the people feeling guilty. Don't tell them the truth. They'll keep the sacrifices coming, and we can keep profiting from it. So God says, like people, like priest. What's going to happen to the people, verse 6? My people are destroyed. So just like they're going to be destroyed, so also the ones who led them down that path are going to be destroyed as well. You know, in this verse we have priest and people receiving the same judgment. And there's no indication that either party is being judged more harshly. But when I read this verse, I thought of what we have in the New Testament. In James 3:1, you know the passage. My brethren, be not many masters, or let not many of you become teachers. And why? The greater condemnation or a stricter judgment. We've got a lot of teachers in this room today. We've got elders here. We've got evangelists here. We've got men who lead in the church, if not from an official capacity, from a capacity as pillars in the church. And the Bible is very clear that when the judgment day comes, God's going to hold your feet to the fire in a way He's not going to hold others. And it does us well to remember that. These priests were supposed to be leading the people the right way. Their sin not only led them on a highway to hell and on a path to destruction, but it had influence over all these other people. And that's the thing with being a teacher and a leader. In Luke chapter 12, Jesus tells the parable, starting in about verse 42 there, of the two servants. And remember that the master leaves a servant in charge of the house. This servant's going to take care of things over the household while the master's gone. And the master comes back and finds that he's not doing what he should have done. And I think it's noteworthy what he says in Luke 12:47. That servant who knew his master's will and did not prepare himself or do according to his will, shall be beaten with many stripes. But he who did not know yet committed things deserving of stripes shall be beaten with few. For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required, and to him whom much has been committed, of him they will ask the more. When I was in Ghana with Charles Fry 9 years ago, it's hot in West Africa. It's real hot in West Africa. It kind of feels like a bad Midwest summer day. I mean, you know the Midwest is really kind of a jungle in the summer. I mean, you look at our forests, it's just all over the place. Everything's very green. It's just sweltering hot and the humidity. That's kind of what the jungle's like, except all the time. And in some ways, it kind of felt like home. Charles is from Bakersfield, as you know, and it's dry as could be there. He also had 20-some years on me, and I was about 40 pounds lighter then than I am now. So the heat was easier for me to take than it was for him. And we got to talking about things like this verse mentions in Luke 12. Notice, the one who knew and disobeyed is beaten with many stripes. The one who disobeyed but didn't know is beaten with few. We were talking about this, and Charles likened it to that sun. He said, you know, you and I have the same sun beating down on us right now, but our experiences with that sun are different. And that may be what the Lord means here. In hell, those who knew, you teachers, who had all that impact on people, and I hope none of us experiences this, but those who knew, hell will be a terrible place for them, as it will be for everyone, but that much worse, because what will they be saying to themselves for eternity? I knew. I don't rule out, however, the possibility that God may have greater punishment in mind. I realize that's not typical teaching, but I don't know that that's something to rule out. We do know from Luke chapter 19 that if you handle responsibility well here, the Lord will give you accordingly in heaven. He makes that very clear. Those who handled their talent well, he gives some control over 5 cities, some control over 10. How you handle responsibility here will lead God to give you certain types of responsibility in heaven. Not a greater reward, but certain roles. You know, we don't have equal responsibility here now. Some of us have more, some of us have less in the Lord's church. God has always divvied things out like that, and he's going to do so in heaven. So there's going to be a different experience for individuals who are all saved in heaven, and I think there's going to be a different experience in hell, whether it's from God or whether it's within. But it's something to keep in mind. God's going to reward them for their deeds, he says at the end of the verse. There are a lot of people we know who want to say that works don't matter, but God makes it very clear they do. What you do, your works follow you. We're going to receive the things done in the body. So now these priests who love to eat and who are eating up the sin of God's people, verse 10, they shall eat, but not have enough. They shall commit harlotry, but not increase, because they have ceased obeying the Lord. In chapter 4, earlier in the chapter, verse 3, remember he had said, the land will mourn, there's drought coming. And I think that's what he's speaking to here. In Haggai chapter 1, God said to the people, you have sown much and bring in little. You eat, but do not have enough. This is God's punishment for you not handling his work aright. In Leviticus 26, this was one of the punishments God said he would bring on the people. Leviticus 26, 26. When I have cut off your supply of bread, then women shall bake your bread in one oven, and they shall bring back your bread by weight, and you shall eat it and not be satisfied. God had said all the way back then that if you're not faithful, if you follow after the harlotry that's in your heart, then the day is going to come where I'm going to make it so that the bread that's even made is going to be brought back to you by weight. You're going to be watching very carefully what you eat because there's not going to be much to eat. Rationing may be the idea that's being spread here. Your appetite, which you've been able to fill to the full, the day's coming when you're not going to be able to do that at all. They shall commit adultery, he says in verse 10, but they will not what? Increase. Now, what did he said earlier? They had increased. But the increase they had enjoyed now is going to stop. And that helps us understand that the increase does include numbers. They had numerically increased. The priesthood had gotten bigger. But they're not going to be able to increase anymore. You're going to try to multiply. Maybe you're going to find that you and your wife aren't seeming to have children. The children aren't seeming to be born as much as they were. So you're going to bring in more concubines. You're going to go engage in ritual harlotry. You're going to engage in all forms of adultery in the hopes of reproducing. But I'm not going to let it happen. What does this tell us about having children? It's a blessing. You know, this punishment is predicated on that idea. This was going to be a punishment to the people. And I feel a little more comfortable bringing this up because Mike brought it up last week. The idea that perhaps we should reconsider, some of us anyway, I don't know, perhaps we should, what children are in the eyes of God. In Psalm 127, starting in verse 3, we have that famous passage, "Behold, children are an heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them." You know, our society does not view children as a reward. They're a penalty. Sexual relation is the reward. It's the end. Children are this unfortunate thing that happens as a result of it, and then we have to deal with them. When I was in college, I remember sitting in class with two girls in the class, and they had a conversation. It was a very brief exchange about how they hated children. Now, I think that's very much against nature. I think a man and a woman, they have certain natures, and I think women by nature are nurturers. If you didn't get a lot of money and prestige in our society for being a doctor, I think we'd have a lot more women doctors than we do men, maybe. Because women by nature are the nurturers. They want those children. We're seeing that now. Feminism's, you know, a woman pursues this career and is away from home all the time, then she hits 35 or something and she thinks, boy, I'd like to have a child before all this is done. I think that's the natural way. This thing, I hate children. I think that's unnatural. I think it's partly tied to the fact that probably the children those girls had been around were nightmares. You know, children are a beautiful thing, but I admit, for me personally, there's very little that's more grating on my nerves than an ill-behaved child. They are miserable to be around when they're ill-behaved. But children are a reward, says God, and they're like arrows. What's the benefit of an arrow versus a sword, for example? Yeah, you don't have to be close. It reaches out. You know, if I'm in warfare and all I've got is this sword in my hand, I've got to wait till my enemy's right up here, till he's on me. I'd much rather shoot an arrow when he's way over there. Get him before he gets close. With an arrow, I can pass my influence well beyond where it is right now. And I think that's the idea in Psalm 127. Psalm 127, yes. That with children, if we'll raise them the way the Lord wants us to, I can lead a godly life here, my family can, and we can touch a lot of people. But now as I send the children out of the home, they're touching people that I couldn't myself. But my influence is extended, my good influence. And I admit, you know, as when I start talking about this subject, in the back of my mind, I realize the risk I'm running because someone's saying to themselves, oh, this is a John's got a bee in his bonnet, or he's feeling self-righteous about having his five children. That's not what's going on here. But I appreciated the fact that Mike touched on it. I hope he doesn't regret having brought it up now that I'm capitalizing on it. But we ought to reconsider, perhaps.
John,
yes.
As an archer, the skill of the arrow lay in the man who holds the bow.
Mark said, as an archer, which he is, The skill of the arrow rests in the hands of the archer. It was well put. Yeah, that's right. We don't do the church, the Lord, or those children any favors if we're not going to handle them right. But so what I'm saying is predicated on that. Like what Rick said last week, he first counsels couples to want children, then have them. If you don't want children, that don't have them. Oh, I don't know. Never mind. I don't know how we're going to... We don't have children by using some of these methods, which I'm not too sure about. So let's just have God's view of children. And think of all the good that will do for the church. You know? We see the church shrinking. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Or we think we do. I'm not sure if our groups really have shrunk or not. But we feel like things are shrinking. The world's impinging on us and pushing the borders in rather than pushing them out. But numerically, we could help ourselves if all the godly couples in the church would have multiple children and teach them in the way of the Lord. It would just by itself expand, which may have been the Lord's plan all along. Let's pick up in verse 11 now. Now God begins to speak to the specific idolatry or its effects on the people. Harlotry, wine, and new wine enslave the heart. My people ask counsel from their wooden idols, and their staff informs them. For the spirit of harlotry has caused them to stray, and they have played the harlot against their God. They offer sacrifices on the mountaintops and burn incense on the hills, under oaks, poplars, and terebinths, because their shade is good. Therefore your daughters commit harlotry, and your brides commit harlotry. I will not punish your daughters when they commit harlotry, nor your brides when they commit adultery, for the men themselves go apart with harlots and offer sacrifices with a ritual harlot. Therefore, people who do not understand will be trampled. Harlotry, physical and spiritual. In other words, in this society now given over to idolatry, as we've discussed, there's rampant fornication. There's fornication in life. There's fornication in worship, the ritual prostitution. And as Janet pointed out for us last week, Janice, pardon me, that there may have even been public displays of prostitution and fornication in the idolatrous worship. They enslave the heart, he says. Wine and new wine. Amos chapter 4, verse 1. Hear what Amos says about the times. Hear this word, he says to the women, you cows of Bashan. He said it, I didn't. Who are on the mountain of Samaria, who say to your husbands, bring wine, let us drink. This was the attitude of the women. More booze, more wine, more liquor, let us drink. In Isaiah 28, twice, in verses 1 and 3, he mentions the drunkards of Ephraim. Drunkenness typified the times. It's always part of much of idolatry. In the New Testament, what problem in the church do we have which would indicate this? What was happening at Corinth? They're getting drunk at the Lord's table. Where'd they get a crazy idea like that? That seemed perfectly normal to former idolaters. Getting drunk at a festival. They'd brought that into the church. Now, he says that the fornication and the wine and the new wine, this rampant sin, my New King James says it enslaves the heart. That sounds like we're addressing addiction here. And that is certainly true. And I know it was touched on last week. All of these things will become addictive and make us just feel like we can't get free of them. And in that sense, enslave us. My New King James is all alone on that translation, though. I noticed a lot of the other translations all render it, take away. And I think that probably is the better idea. Not that they enslave the heart, although that's true, but they take away the heart. The heart is that innermost part of us, where we think, where we feel. It's our capacity for thinking and reasoning as we should. Your translations render it understanding. In other words, the people's ability to feel and think as they should and must in order to make right spiritual decisions, it's been taken away because they've abused these things. Fornication and drunkenness have left them spiritually handicapped. Their sins deceived them and it's hardened their hearts. You know, you continue in any sin long enough and your heart's going to get hard. But you continue in these types of sins and it's worse because they are addicting. Any of you in this room who have dealt with an addiction know the power it has over you if you let it. I remember in high school I knew a guy who was a smoker and he would tell me when he was needing a smoke, he'd say, I'm having a nick fit. The nicotine was crying out for something. And it can get to the point where it just is totally consuming. And when you're consumed by those sins, and every time you get away from them, before long you're thinking about getting back into them, how can you think about spiritual things? In Isaiah 28, let's turn over there. Isaiah describes for us the effects of the drunkenness and the extent to which they had gone. Isaiah 28. Verses 7 and 8. Isaiah 28, 7 and 8. They also have erred through wine, and through intoxicating drink are out of the way. The priest and the prophet have erred through intoxicating drink. They are swallowed up by wine. They are out of the way through intoxicating drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. We would expect that from someone who's drunk. For all tables are full of vomit and filth. No place is clean. Now that's a very descriptive picture. And this is the point to which it had come. Imagine, I met a guy in college. I lived next door to guys who on a very regular basis would go out to the bars and pick up women and drink too much. And they had a friend who came to visit once. We had two rooms. Myself and another member of the church were in one room. They were in the other, and it was connected to a common area. So I didn't have to see too much of it necessarily, but I saw some of it. And they had one man come down to visit. He may have lived up in this area. And from the moment he woke up to the moment he went to bed, he drank. That's the point it had come to for him. Is it first Wednesday of the month? That's what it is. Okay. I've never been here during the day on the first Wednesday of the month. We may talk about that tomorrow. Sorry.
Yeah, for those of you from out west, they do this once a month just to test the siren.
Do they have sirens like that in California?
They used to.
They used to? Only what? Only. Yeah.
Can we get that on tape?
This is where I am stopped. Okay, back to Hosea. So consumed with these sins, they of course don't have an understanding heart with respect to God's ways. They maybe not can't even think about the things they need to be thinking about because they're so consumed with these sins, like that man I was just describing to you. From the time you wake up to the time you go to bed, these are the things that are on your mind. When can I get over to the feast? When can I get the next drink? When can I go to the next prostitute? It becomes all consuming. Remember those men in Sodom? I mean, they surround the house that night. They are consumed. It's what's on their mind. And so also may have been Israel. My people ask counsel from their wooden idols, and their staff informs them. I think this is to show us how far gone they are. This is how silly their religion has become. In Isaiah 44, I should have had you stay in Isaiah. In Isaiah 44, Isaiah describes it for us in a way to help us see how silly it is. That's the idea. Isaiah 44, starting in verse 16. Right at the end of verse 15, he says, "He makes it a carved image and falls down to it." Talking about wood here. Verse 16, "He burns half of it in the fire. With this half he eats meat. He roasts a roast and is satisfied. He even warms himself and says, 'I am warm. I have seen the fire.' And the rest of it he makes into a god, a carved image. He falls down before it and worships it, prays to it, and says, 'Deliver me, for you are my God.' They did not know nor understand, for he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot understand. And no one considers in his heart, nor is there knowledge nor understanding to say, 'I have burned half of it in the fire. Yes, I have also baked bread on its coals. I have roasted meat and eaten it. And shall I make the rest of it an abomination? Shall I fall down before a block of wood?'" And then notice at the end of verse 20, "Is there not a lie in my right hand?" That's the idea. This is preposterous. That people have become so hardened in their sins, so deceived by what other people are doing, that they've bought into this. And you know, I have to admit, once in a while, there have been times where I've thought, well, you know, not having those passages in mind, maybe there was something about this to make it seem more reasonable, more sensible, but God wants us to see it for the absolutely ridiculous thing that it was. We've got a comment here from Chad.
Do you feel like religious organizations are immune from this today?
Could you say that again, Chad?
Do you feel like the religious organizations are immune from this type of thing today in the upper echelon?
No, not at all.
I think there's a great danger that's just among us that we don't even know about.
You want to expound on that some? Maybe particulars?
I don't know the particulars. I know okay. Some of the... I don't know the statistics okay. on it, no. But I do know that there's a lot there.
Okay.
That is, people are being deceived by a lot of people that are following a lot of the same things that you're talking about here. Not the idolatry so much, somewhat, but the wine and the drugs and so forth that go with a lot of the others.
Ah,
it's in
okay.
the world, religious world.
Okay. Thank you. You're right.
Isn't this what happened to Nate Evan by you?
I'm sorry, could you say it again, Mike?
Isn't this what happened to Nadab and Abihu?
Sure, yeah, right. There is an implication there later on in the chapter that they had been drinking. That's right. And you don't drink and present yourself to the Lord because then you might do something foolish like they did. Absolutely. Good point. You know, Chad wasn't exactly speaking to this, but I guess I'd like to throw it in there. The idea that the idolatry really was just ridiculous, and yet people had bought into it. I do think there's more and more of this in the quote-unquote world of Christianity, Christendom. I mean, you turn on these Christian stations and you see what's on there. I mean, we've got these big gilt chairs and these people with huge hair. I mean, do they think that looks good? I mean, you look at, what was she thinking when she looked in the mirror? Did she think that looks good? There's this weird, silly facade. And you do have people who've bought into it, but you know what? You've got a lot of people out here who are looking at that, and what are they saying? Christianity is ridiculous. If that's Christianity, I don't want anything to do with it. And we show up at their doorstep, or they find out we're Christian, and that's what they think about. And it makes Jesus look silly. And it's unfortunate. And I think we do need to be careful of that sort of thing, because maybe not the extreme I just described, but there can be some things that people get all excited about in the denominational world, and if we're not real careful, we can let it seep into our thinking. Chad had another comment, and then we'll keep moving here.
You're speaking about the drinking of these people and the priests and so forth. Then think of the 35th chapter of Jeremiah, when Jonadab considered the people, that his tribe, what was best for them, and he did not have them drink. That lasted for 230-some years.
Okay.
That, and how he was able to do that is unbelievable. Amongst people that were living the way they were living, and yet he so instilled this in his family life that for 230-some years they didn't drink and wouldn't drink, and God uses it as an object lesson for his own people.
And you're referring to the Rechabites, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, Jonadab.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Jeremiah 35. Chad says, it's an interesting event that you've got these people who'd been faithful to their father all these years, and yet God wasn't, or that the people of Israel weren't faithful to their heavenly father. Let's keep moving now. Their staff informs them. This is interesting. Homer Haley writes, the staff seems to indicate the use of rods in the practice of witchcraft or magic. The rods, held upright, would be released after magic formulas were said over them. The direction in which the rod fell indicated the answer to the question posed. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown write this. I know it can sometimes be hard to listen to someone read, but if you'll bear with me. The diviner threw a rod from him, which was stripped of its bark on one side, not on the other. If the bare side turned uppermost, it was a good omen. If the side of the bark, it was a bad omen. The Arabs used two rods, the one marked God bids, the other God forbids. Whichever came out first in drawing out of a case gave the omen for or against an understanding. So this is what we're talking about. You have these rods and you speak out to Baal or whoever your God is. Do I do thus and so? Shall I go up to battle? Shall I marry this woman? Whatever it is. And you toss them and he has spoken. Joseph was said to use this sort of thing. This was his steward talking. It wasn't Joseph. Genesis 44:5, is not this the one, the cup from which my Lord drinks and with which he indeed practices divination? Now notice, again, Joseph is not the one talking. His steward is saying that about him. It could be that God bore with Joseph in that prior to the giving of the law. The Babylonians, we know, had men who would do this. They were called Baru, which meant, it came from a word which meant to see, and they were believed to be able to see the will of the gods. You'd put oil and water in a cup and see how it moved around in there, and you'd say, well, the gods must be saying thus and so. They'd look at the entrails on an animal or the markings on the liver of a sacred animal. You'd watch the sky, just like the astrologers do today, and have you noticed how that's growing? I mean, astrology is something that some people are putting a lot of stock in based on what I hear. As I understand it, there's a lot that goes on in the stock market that is based on astrology. You've got people in high positions making decisions based on this sort of thing. They'd look at the flights of birds or dreams, which I think we need to be careful of. Sometimes I hear people make an awful lot out of dreams. And I'm not entirely sure what to think about that sometimes. We know Nebuchadnezzar did this sort of thing. In Ezekiel 21:21, it says, for the king of Babylon stands at the parting of the road, at the fork of two roads. He's got a decision to make. He shakes the arrows. He consults the images. He looks at the liver. Nebuchadnezzar himself was doing this in order to make the right decision on what he was going to do. God gave something to Israel so that they wouldn't go into these things. And what was it? All right, they had the Urim and the Thummim. They had the ephod. They also had certain types of people to help them avoid this. What were they? The prophets. God is clear about that. We won't read it, but in Deuteronomy 18, verses 9 through 15, God says, you're coming into the land of Canaan. You've got these sorcerers. You've got this witchcraft, means by which people try to discern the will of the gods. I do not do those things. I'm giving you a prophet. So if you want to know what you should do, you go to him. You ask, and he'll give you the word of the Lord. God made provision. It wasn't that the people were without witness, that they felt like, oh, we just, you know, the Canaanites seem to know what they need to do. They're able to get an answer from the gods. I can't get anything. The prophets were there, and they disregarded him. He says at the end of verse 12, the spirit of harlotry, the spirit of harlotry has caused them to stray. We're going to look at that when we get to the fifth chapter. In chapter 5, verse 4, he mentions it again, and it's significant. There was something in them now at work that really had almost, if not entirely, made it impossible for them to serve the Lord. Now, it hadn't taken them over. They had let it. But they had gotten to the point where serving God wasn't an option. They were too hardened. Verse 13 now. They offer sacrifices on the mountaintops, burn incense on the hills. We know about that. Those are the high places. Under oaks, poplars, and terebinths, because their shade is good. Therefore, he says, your daughters commit harlotry and your brides commit adultery. Well, there's nothing wrong with wanting some shade. That's fine. But what's the point? You're choosing your places of worship based on what? Comfort. That's the problem. You've not looked to me. I will record my name in certain places so you can worship there, but that's not what's led you to make your decision. You're making a decision because, boy, it's got some nice trees up there. We're going to be in the shade. No problem at all. When I was in Ghana again, in Accra, in Kumasi, where we spent most of our time, they would meet on Sunday morning out in this park. They've since gotten a building, but they were meeting out in the park, and there were some trees, but there was an awful lot of unshaded area. They sat out on these wooden benches with no back. We were out there for hours. They listened to four sermons, told us later that Charles and I's sermons had been too short, and the sun would be bearing down. They'd heard two sermons before Charles and mine, and then Charles and I got up there, gave your normal length sermon, and they told us the following day, the brethren liked your sermons. They had one complaint. They were too short. And they're out here in the sun. They moved us to try to keep us in the shade. They knew we couldn't take it as well. But, you know, they weren't necessarily choosing their place. Maybe that was the most comfortable place they had. But they didn't let discomfort stand in their way. And this people, comfort was their chief obligation. I do think it's interesting. I don't think it's wrong. But I do think it's interesting that when I go to older meeting houses in the Brotherhood, their pews don't have the cushions. But we like to have cushions now, and that's fine. But it's telling. It's telling. You know, if you don't have air conditioning these days, you feel like you're underprivileged. And I grew up without it, for the most part. And that was very typical of the generation before me. We're getting awful soft. Awful soft. And we want to be careful we don't let it get in the way of our service to God, because it had for these people. Who was committing harlotry and adultery based on the end of verse 13? And specifically, yeah. You don't have a bunch of single women doing it, which would be bad enough. But these are wives. These are daughters. This is the sort of thing that should have made a man what? Just enraged. My wife is there, and those men are going to her. This is the sort of thing that should have made a man act immediately, to throw everything down and go get his wife, go get his daughter, bring her home, and do everything in his power to stop it. But they're fine with it. God says in verse 14, I'm not going to punish your daughters when they commit adultery, nor your brides when they commit harlotry, nor your brides when they commit adultery. Not that I'm not going to punish them at all, but I'm not going to give them anything extra. The whole nation's going to get trampled. I'm not giving them anything extra or special. And why? Because you men are doing the same thing. Your wife, your daughter, is over here at thus and so high place. And you're going over at the other high place. And you're committing ritual fornication with someone else's wife. And someone else's daughter. And in Amos, let me get that passage here. Amos chapter 2, verse 7. This is a passage worth your notes if you're taking them. Amos says for us, a man and his father go into the same girl to defile my holy name. This, of course, was a complete abomination in the eyes of the Lord. They're letting their wives, their daughters go to these places. You know, wife gets home, well, how's your day? Just fine. And the husbands and the sons are going into the very same woman. So I'm not going to punish your daughters. I'm not going to punish your brides any more than I'm going to punish you. In fact, in all truth, who has the greater guilt, the men or the women? It's going to be the men. In Romans chapter 5, we know Eve was the first one to sin, but Paul tells us through one man, sin entered the world. Man is held accountable. Acts chapter 5, I think, is a very interesting example of this. Ananias sells that piece of land, and then he lies about it. And it says that Sapphira knows. She wasn't in on the selling, but she's in on the lie. Ananias comes into where Peter is, and what's Peter say? He tears right into him. You have lied. It was in your power. You could have done with it what you will, but Satan has filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit, and Ananias dies. Sapphira comes in a little later, and what's Peter do? He asks her, did you sell the land for so much? Why is he doing that? Because she was following. She was the wife. I'm going to give you a second chance. The men were really the ones who were more guilty. But both are guilty, and in the end, verse 14, therefore people who do not understand will be trampled. We're a little bit into your 15 minutes. Are there any comments or questions? We've got one down here. Kimber.
John, it just struck me when you were reading that in verse 13. Just to add insult to injury, the woman gets all gussied up. She's just laying around with her curlers on at home. And then to go out, she gets all dressed up, puts on her jewelry, and leaves.
Now, what
That's
verse are you...
That's verse 13, back in chapter 2.
Okay, yes.
I was sort
Thank
of
you.
Roaming while you were... Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Good.
Sorry, chapter 2, verse 13. She decked herself with her earrings and jewelry and went after her lovers.
Okay.
It's just adding insult to injury.
Yeah. We go to trouble to serve the Lord, to serve these idols.
In chapter 4, verse 8, in 7 and 8, with the priests feeding on the sins of the people, there's also an interesting contrast that's being drawn because the people were supposed to feed the priests, but they were supposed to feed the priests out of the righteous offerings, not out of the sin offerings.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting contrast. And then down along with comfort in verse 13, chapter 4, verse 13, think of the idea of the canopy of the trees. What's it doing? Well, it's shading them from the eyes of God. And, you can go back all the way to the Garden of Eden. You could go forward to the writings of the Apostle Paul. So there's a greater implication than just comfort there.
Okay. Yeah, I know what you're talking about with the offerings the people were to eat. Do you think that Leviticus 6:26 may imply that they or the priests could eat the sin offering also? You can comment on it later if you want to. Leviticus 6:26 seems to imply to me that that was permissible under certain circumstances. But it was different from the wave offering and the heave offering, which I don't think there was the holy place confinement that I recall. Okay. Anything else?
Now, these things are happening in the 10 tribes, right? Basically,
yes.
That's who he's speaking to.
Yeah, it's going on in Judah, but to a lesser degree.
That's right. But you see, they didn't have the things that Judah should have, that they had left the things. Like in Jeremiah 18:18, where the law shall not perish from the priest, nor counsel from the elders or wise, nor word from the prophets. So these three things are the guiding principles for the children of Israel. And they had left those. And this is a result of what happens when you leave those principles. Now, Jeremiah or Hezekiah had these three, worked with these three principles when he was king. That's why he was so successful. He listened to the prophets, he counseled with the elders, and he listened to heard the law. This is what happens when you don't use the things that God gave you to use.
Excellent comment. Thank you, Chad. We've got a comment down here. Or was there one back there already?
No, I didn't sit back.
Okay. Janice had one here. That was Jeremiah 18:18. And Ezekiel 7:26, you can connect with that.
I was just looking back at the verse
in NIV, it says there's a spirit of prostitution that leads your people astray.
Yes.
And just got me to thinking about the way our young ladies are dressing today. I'm not saying in the church, but I see it at school. Dwayne sees them in the store and he says, why do they dress like that? They're just giving it away. And I think about promos I see sometimes or billboards. Mm-hmm. Not just the way people dress, but the entertainments that people pay to see or engage in. Yeah. And I'm wondering, isn't that a spirit of prostitution? It seems like our culture no longer believes in the sanctity of marriage. We believe we can go and have relations with any number of people, any number of times, mm-hmm. and go on to the next one. Yeah. Isn't that a spirit of prostitution? And it's our entire world seems to be going astray this way.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly a type of spirit of prostitution. I think specifically here we're talking about a spirit of spiritual prostitution. But sure, I mean, the two come together. You know, there's a certain website I frequent with news, and this website links to articles all over the web and all over the world. And I've noticed that there are certain, and you don't know where the article's coming from until you've clicked on it a lot of the time, but you click on it, and when it takes you to articles in Britain, the advertisements are considerably more brazen than are the advertisements here in America. And that's just because they're a few steps ahead of us. We always catch up. We're well on our way.
I was just going to say, I think one reason that they dress like that is because young men pay them more attention. They get rewarded. So a lot of times the young men seem to give the wrong message there too, I think. So just our Amen. Young ladies, it's our young men too.
Amen. And this goes back to what Tom said last week or early this week about how we need to teach our boys to treat women and think of women with purity. She's not an object for your satisfaction, your self-centered satisfaction. She's to be cherished like that piece of china that you give special care to. Did you have something, Gordon? Okay. We've got a hand down here, Tom. Dion, right here. I've always taught not to point, but I find myself doing it.
In your study of Hosea, have you ever come across a disappointment or a sadness on the part of Hosea in the plan that God had for him with the marriage to a prostitute and the family sadness?
Yeah, yeah.
Wouldn't you feel sad if that was the situation?
Sure.
I don't know. Do you ever run across that while you're studying?
No. Now, I'm sure that was there. The first three chapters, I think, are the exclusive portion of Hosea where it's discussed, and we're not really given too much insight into how Hosea felt. I think, you know, it's obvious, though, because of our own experience, this of how Hosea must have felt, and Hosea is supposed to be experiencing what God was. So, yeah. You know, as I said on Friday, when we jump over to the 11th chapter, we get a little bit of feel for God's love for Israel and how he hates to see them go down the road they're going. Steve?
Just on that last question, that's what I see and feel in Hosea 2:6. She did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal.
Verse 8?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it's with respect to God, but 2:13 stands out to me. When this is God speaking, it's not Hosea, but she decked herself with her earrings and her jewelry, went after her lover, she went to all this trouble, but me she forgot. Here I am, a faithful husband, ready to love her and do everything for her, and I have been, and she won't come home. She goes off with these other men, and Hosea must have felt that way. It's rejection. Anything else? Kathy had a comment.
We don't know if Gomer and Hosea lived long enough to really get their marriage back to the ideal state. But there, at least it leaves us with hope at the end of the third chapter in the fifth verse, because it says, afterward, the Israelites will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They will come trembling to the Lord and to his blessings in the last days. So there is that, if we can, you know, hope that Hosea and Gomer have the same consistency of the prophecy and what happens, yeah, that perhaps they did finally reconcile.
That's a nice thought. Well, let's cover just a little bit more material while we have the opportunity. Verse 15, at least we can get started on this. Though you, Israel, play the harlot, let not Judah offend. Do not come up to Gilgal, nor go up to Beth-Aven, nor swear an oath, saying, as the Lord lives. Judah, do not imitate your sister. You see what's coming. And by the way, we know these prophecies were getting down to the southern kingdom, because in 2 Chronicles 30, Hosea or Hezekiah, when he sends those messengers up there to get him to come down for the Passover, he encourages them to keep in mind that there's destruction coming, but if they'll change their ways, the captivity might not be as harsh. Something along those lines. Check it out. But Judah, do not be guilty of the same thing. And here is how you could be guilty, so don't do it. Do not come up to Gilgal. Now, Gilgal's probably the city here between Jericho and the Jordan. It's down in the northern kingdom, but just barely. If they have kept their borders, which are all the way down to the Dead Sea, where Jeroboam had pushed them, this has Gilgal in the northern kingdom. It's about 2 miles from Jericho. Where have we heard of Gilgal before? Who came there very early on? Joshua. When the children of Israel crossed the Jordan River and came into Canaan for the first time, it was at Gilgal that they camped. It was there that they set up the stones, I believe. It would have been close to Judah, and I think that's the point. We're going to find out there's idolatry going on there, and it's close to Judah. So don't go there. It's easily accessible to you, but don't go. Now, Gilgal had a wonderful history. Joshua had come there, and it was there, Joshua chapter 5, verses 2 through 7, that they had circumcised the men. The men who'd come out from Egypt were not circumcised. The spirit of harlotry was already working there. They weren't circumcised. They had been circumcised, but they hadn't bothered to circumcise their sons. So here's the second generation. They're circumcised at Gilgal, and it was there that God said in Joshua 5:9, "This day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." That uncircumcision, which was still the mark of their harlotry back in Egypt, that had been rolled away. It was there they'd celebrated the Passover, Joshua 5:10. And it was there that Samuel had done his sacrificing. This apparently was a holy place in the days of Samuel. When he anointed Saul in 1 Samuel 10, he sent him to Gilgal and said, "I'm going to join you there, and I will make a sacrifice there." And when Saul destroyed the Amalekites, all of them except Agag and the animals, they went to Gilgal. Why? Now, we're going to sacrifice these animals. This was good. But Gilgal was a holy place. Good things had gone on there. It had a good history, but it had become a seat of idolatry. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. I appreciate your attention.